Welcome to Inclusion Catalyst with your hosts, Mickey Desai and Susan Cooper. We invite diversity leaders to the table to deconstruct complex social justice issues and showcase the best inclusion practices in our workplaces and our communities.
Hello and welcome. This is the Inclusion Catalyst. I am one of your hosts, Mickey Desai. We also have
Susan Cooper.
And our guest for the day is Julius Pryor III. Julius, you have a long and interesting history in the diversity and inclusion field. Can you do a quick summary of your history and what you're currently up to?
Sure. I have something of an eclectic background. I was an officer in the Navy for a number of years. After that, went to work for a string of corporations. Takeda Pharmaceuticals, Abbott Labs, now called AbbVie, Russell Athletic, Johnson & Johnson, Coca-Cola Enterprises, Genentech, a subsidiary of Roche, one of the premier and leading biotech companies in the world. And I'm currently doing some work with Cerner Corporation, which is on the leading edge of digitalization of medical records and utilizing data around genomics and a number of other things to assist physicians about treatment paradigms. So I've done some pretty interesting things over the course of my career. It's not over yet. And in each of those roles, I was involved in leveraging diversity to drive outcomes for those organizations.
And that's, I guess, the big question. And the thing that we're going to talk about the most today is how do you do exactly that? How do you get that leverage?
Yeah, well, when you hear the word diversity, what is it that you normally think about?
I think most people think about racial diversity, but I think there's a lot more to it than that.
Yeah, I think that you're absolutely right, Susan. Most people immediately think about demographic representation. They think about workforce representation. Well, let me give you an example of how I've leveraged diversity. I'll give you one example, and then if we have time, I'll give you one or two more. And this sort of sums up not only the way that I approach thinking about this work, but it also gives you an interesting story about how I initially got involved. I was working at a pharmaceutical company, and we just got an approval for a molecule to be used in the treatment of prostate cancer in men. It was a very interesting compound. It was what is known as a LHRH agonist, a luteinizing hormone, releasing hormone agonist, very similar to a naturally occurring substance in the body. And it acted to reduce the production of sex hormone. So in the male physiology, it shut down production of testosterone, and in the female physiology, it downregulated production of estradiol, which is a precursor to estrogen. Any diseases that are related to levels of those hormones or elevated levels of those hormones can be controlled to a certain degree. So we got our first FDA approval to use this molecule in the palliative treatment of prostate cancer in men. And as I was learning more about the compound, learning more about the molecule, learning more about how it worked, I was shocked to learn that African-American men have a 60% greater incidence of prostate cancer than the general population. So I immediately went back to other managers in the company and said, look, we need to be spending more time with black doctors. They've got to be seeing more of these patients than anybody else. And then I was really surprised when the responses I got were, well, Julius, you know, those doctors are in the less desirable geographical areas. Their patients aren't compliant. They don't want to see salespeople. Heck, they don't even pay their bills on time. And I said, wow, what is it that I'm trying to think about? What do we call what you all just told me? Oh, yeah, stereotypes. Well, I responded that the medical specialty that treats prostate cancer, in addition to oncology, are urologists. I affectionately call the plumbers of the medical profession. But I said, I personally know two African-American urologists that are tenure professors at medical schools. I don't understand where you're getting this from. So I learned my first valuable lesson about doing this work, which is even when my gut instincts are right, I still need empirical data to support what it is I'm trying to move forward. So I went and got permission from the VP of sales to do a demonstration project. And I asked him if I could target three black urologists in three separate geographical areas. And my goal was to persuade them to put 30% of their patients on this molecule. And it was very easy to track because the patient didn't actually go to a pharmacy to pick this up. It was an IM, an intramuscular injection. The physician actually had to order it in his or her office and then give the injection in the office once per month. It was a monthly depot formulation. So it was very easy to keep track of what was being used, how much was being used, when it was being used. And within 6 months, we not only converted 30% of their patients, they converted every eligible patient that they had and were adding new patients. And this is phenomenal because urologists are primarily surgeons, and a lot of the work that they do is to go in and do surgical interventions. So to have them actually convert this many patients to our molecule was pretty phenomenal. And we were doing a lot more than simply increased calls and talking to them about the medicine. We were supporting a lot of work they wanted to do, attending symposia. We were supporting research they wanted to do. We were doing a lot of prostate cancer screenings for an at-risk community, and we were doing a lot of education in this underserved population. So we got these phenomenal results. I was constantly telling the leaders in the organization how we were doing in terms of driving this. And a decision was then made to roll this out nationally. And so we rolled this strategy out nationally. We targeted all of the a number of physicians across the nation, but in particular, African-American urologists. And at the time, and this number unfortunately hasn't changed, at the time, African-American urologists were about 3.6% of the total urology population. Mm-hmm. And that 3.6% was driving almost 20% of the total sales of the medicine. And this was not an inexpensive formulation. It was driving all sorts of top-line growth. It was driving market share. It was driving revenue for the company. So basically, less than 4% of the targeted population was driving almost 20% of the total sales. And it was basically the kickoff for the two joint partners that led over the next 3 years to this being a global billion-dollar blockbuster. So it was a phenomenal outcome. And the reason I wanted to tell you that as an example is because of what happened shortly afterwards. The president of the company was very impressed and said, wow, this was a very unique approach. These roles in diversity were just beginning to be created. And he asked me to create a diversity strategy for the company and to formally take this on as a new role. And I'll never forget Mickey and Susan. I was in his office and I said, yeah, let's do this. And before I could get out of the door, I spun around and said, wait a minute, I don't know anything about this. What are you asking me to do? But we came to a meeting of the minds, and it pushed me into an entirely new career path. Uh-huh. But really, think about what I just did. Think about what I just told you. Think about what I did, that there were some key things that I did, and there were some key things that I didn't do. I gathered empirical data, which was the first and foremost thing, about the marketplace, about the physicians who were calling on, about the patient population. We connected with the customer in a way that was going to benefit a lot of the work that they were doing, provided a lot of good information to the at-risk population. I effectively communicated with all of the leaders within our organization. I told them what we were doing, how we were doing it, what kind of progress we were making. Then I communicated some more. I told them what we were doing, how we were making progress, what kind of results we were getting. And then I communicated some more. And then the other critical thing I did was I developed key relationships with all of the critical leaders in the organization, in particular the VP of sales. And finally, what was our result? Market share increase, revenue stream increase, top line growth that wasn't there before. So it was a huge hit for us. It was a huge success. But I also want you to think about what I did not do. Think about what I didn't do, Mickey and Susan.
The one thing
I never used the words diversity and inclusion.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's true.
And yet, yeah. everything I just described to you is firmly grounded in foundational principles of managing diversity and building an inclusive culture. Within 3 years, we had tripled the number of demographic minorities in key roles in sales, sales management, marketing, finance, accounting, and training from 10% to 30%, and we doubled the number of women from 30% to 60%. Now, as we continue to market the medicine, we also got additional approvals to use the drug in the female population. It was now used, it was dosaged differently, but it was being used to treat endometriosis and uterine myoma or benign fibroid tumors. African-American women over-index for benign fibroid tumors, and Latinas anecdotally show up with a more exacerbated form of endometriosis. So now we already had a template to go after GYNs, gynecologists, in those underserved communities. So we were able to increase the demographic workforce representation because the key leaders in the organization now had a tangible understanding of why this is important. They saw how it was going to affect their goals and objectives, and all of a sudden it made sense to them to be sure that they were paying attention to the people that were being hired and promoted. All I had to do was lean everybody in the right direction. I remember when people talk about Michelangelo and his Statue of David, and they often say, how did you develop the skill sets to carve and create such a beautiful and startling statue? And he said, the statue was there all along. All I did was knock the excess marble away.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So all I had to do was set this up correctly and then lean people in the right direction. And that's the approach I've taken in every organization I've been in when I'm doing this work. I've always figured out what the critical goals and objectives were and aligned, connected, and integrated the strategy with whatever those goals and objectives were. It just so happened that in that organization, the critical goals were around sales and marketing. In other organizations, the goals have been around other things. And I've even done the work in nonprofits and universities. So it still goes back to being sure that you're aligning this with whatever's important.
Right.
It has to be tangible. It has to be manageable. It has to be scalable, and it helps if it's fungible.
Right.
All right, I've talked enough. Ask me some questions. Does any of that make sense?
Yes.
Absolutely, and I have a question that might seem sort of abrasive, and I apologize up front for asking it, but it sounds like, at least in the first case, that the case for a diverse marketing approach for this molecule only gained traction when money was on the line. Is that not a fair characterization?
Well, I was focused on outcomes.
Yeah.
So in that organization, the things that were important were sales, market share, and driving revenue.
Right.
That may or may not be the case in other organizations. This is a for-profit corporation. But at the same time, look at all of the good that we did.
Yeah.
We connected to an underserved population. We connected it with the community. We developed a relationship with an overlooked and underserved physician population. All of the things worked out well, and we ended up with the kind of demographic workforce representation that many companies are envious of. So, again, focus on the outcome. And think about it. As I said, I never used the words diversity and inclusion.
Right.
I talked about the things that were important. And yet, we still did all of the basic tactical things around that people do in diversity and inclusion programs. We created employee resource groups.
We did education and learning programs. We did all sorts of great recruiting, developed great relationships with historically black colleges and universities. But I didn't lead with that. I led with the things that were important in that organization.
You know, that segues really well into a question I wanted to ask you. Since you have worked at many large companies that are well-known brands, like Russell Athletics, Johnson & Johnson, Coca-Cola Company, since my background is in marketing, I wanted to ask you this. Many brands today are moving toward a more purpose-driven approach to their communications and marketing. So how does diversity and inclusion play into a brand's purpose? So that this idea that brands are trying to connect their brand to an audience based on their shared values. They're trying to make it not seem as though they're just out there just to make money and sell their products and services. So how can diversity and inclusion play into this purpose-driven approach?
Yeah, well, again, it seems that the newer entrants to the workforce are looking for organizations like the one you just described. They want to do something more than simply sell a product. They want to be sure that there's some meaning. They want to be sure that there is some objective that is making a difference. So naturally, if you're working in an organization that that is helping to address challenges in oncology, or you're working in an organization that's addressing malignancies as far as cancers are concerned, you're doing something that has purpose. It may be a little more difficult when you're selling soft drinks or chocolate bars, but all of these things serve some sort of purpose, and the whole key is to figure out what the purpose is. Or how it connects with us as human beings, as consumers. You're the expert in marketing, so you'd have to dig pretty deeply to figure out what it is, what the features and benefits are when you're trying to present something to an audience. However, it certainly helps to have people who have unique perspectives in the room when you're making those decisions. So increasingly, who is it that's purchasing the product, and who is it that's making the decisions? And is there a case to be made for being sure that you get as many perspectives around the table as possible? Again, the key is to figure out what it is that's critically important within those organizations and focus on whatever it is that's critically important. I try to stay away from necessarily using the words diversity and inclusion and talk a lot more about what those organizations consider to be important. Did I answer your question, Susan? I sort of talked around it.
Yes.
I was going to ask, you know, I hear you say avoiding the words diversity and inclusion. Are we doing ourselves a disservice by calling it diversity and inclusion, do you think?
Well, I've always wanted to focus on outcomes, and oftentimes, because people don't take the time to define or clarify what those words mean within their organizations, they're making assumptions that everybody, you know what I'm talking about when I use those words, so let's go ahead and talk about what we're going to do. And oftentimes, people don't know what you mean. They have all sorts of ideas based on what they see in the media, what they see in online, what they're hearing, what's in the ether, what's in the echo chambers, what the talking heads and the radio pundits are saying. So the word's been contorted and twisted to mean any number of things. So one of the first things that I always did when I was formally developing a strategy was to be sure that we had conceptual clarity around what we meant, at least within the context of those organizations, when we used those words. And they meant something slightly different depending on what the organization was that I was working in. But we were sure to be clear about what it was that we meant. I've noticed that I've progressed through my career in doing this work, I've talked much more about I use the language of the organizations. So if they're talking about, for instance, the organization that I'm in now is focused on healthcare technology. We're talking a lot about population health and practice paradigms and algorithms, artificial intelligence. So I want to become familiar with how we use those words within the context of what we're trying to drive.
Exactly, which means that the language pertaining to an outcome is way more valuable to the company than some sort of academically prescribed term that sounds like diversity and inclusion.
Well, yeah, and I've noticed some other trends, Mickey and Susan. A lot of the people who are leading these efforts, I don't think, are doing themselves any favors. They talk about diversity programs and training and a lot of other tactical actions, and they never talk about this from a strategic approach. Now, they may say that they're developing a strategy, but most of what I'm seeing are just tactical actions. The other trend that I've noticed is when I started doing this work, my reporting relationships, I've done this in six global companies now. In the first five companies I was reporting into variously, the president of the entire organization, the CEO at the next company. In fact, he was chairman and CEO. The next organization, one of the major consumer business unit heads. At the next organization, the head of all of the North American operations. And only recently did I find myself in the human resources department. Now, the HR practitioners are professionals and they have a role to play. But oftentimes I've noticed that people who are in the HR department think like HR functionaries as opposed to business strategists. I have worked with very good human resources leaders, and I always want to be sure that they're thinking in the right way when they're doing this work. But that's a trend that I'm not sure is a good trend. I'm not sure that these roles actually belong in the human resources department. I've always would rather see them with a direct line to the most senior leader in the organization.
Interesting. Why do you think companies like to set it up that way? Why do you think companies prefer to just have it diversity and inclusion tactical pieces coming out of HR instead of anywhere else?
Well, what is one of the important roles of the human resources department when it comes to people?
Yeah, that's true.
Well, what is it that they're supposed to be hiring and developing and retaining? And,
right.
And again, a lot of people affiliate this work with workforce representation. So they don't see the direct line between driving results for the business. They give it a lot of lip service. I continue to hear people say, yeah, but you know, if you have a demographically diverse board, if you have more women in your organization, if you look at the Dow Jones Industrial or the Russell, if you look at any of the financial indicators, that there is some evidence to state that the more diversity you have by demographic representation, the better you're doing in terms of results. But often, when I will ask people who quote those kinds of statistics to give me a specific example from their organization, they're flummoxed. They can't give me an example similar to the one I just gave you.
Right.
And that's what I want. I want specific examples of how you are leveraging diversity to drive outcomes.
Yep. Very cool. Well, we're almost out of we are almost out of time. Susan, did you have one or two more questions you want to ask?
Yeah, I do. In one of the articles that I saw on your LinkedIn page, there was the idea that we all need to become more comfortable with being uncomfortable. I wondered if you could expound on that a bit.
Well, as much as we talk about innovation and creativity and pushing the envelope and thinking outside of the box, we really don't want to do those things. We'd rather get in our lanes and stay in our lanes. Everybody likes to change, but they say, well, why don't you go first? Everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. Yeah, we all want to go to Valhalla, but no one wants to do what's actually necessary to get there.
Right.
So we've got to push ourselves. One of the other things that's talked about quite a bit when you get around diversity practitioners is we need to have courageous conversations. We need to really get out there and talk about tough stuff. And I'll tell people up front, I say, I'm not a particularly courageous person. I'm just trying to make it through the end of the week. And you're asking me to do something that within the context of a corporation that we can't even do effectively within the country. So I want us to be realistic about these things, but I also want us to continue to push as far as we can as individuals. And a lot of this is just one-on-one talks between one person and another person. So the more and more that we can put ourselves in other people's shoes, the more and more that we can situate ourselves so that we have empathy, the more that we can become more comfortable being uncomfortable, the better we're going to be able to achieve results and move forward.
Yeah, I think that people are starting to kind of learn how to talk about these issues in their day-to-day lives. I think there was a generation before where there was this idea that, oh, everyone should be colorblind. Let's not talk about these issues. Let's not talk about race. Let's not talk about the differences in socioeconomic status because we're all the same. But that's not true, and it's not helpful to not talk about it. It's detrimental.
Susan, you just said that we're doing a better job of talking about these things. You must not watch much cable TV. You must not watch any of the pundits on cable television or listen to any of the radio talkers, because if you listen to them, it doesn't seem like we're making any progress. But
I think there's a movement to push back on that, is what I mean.
Yeah, I think, I guess in the end, I'm an eternal optimist. And I hope that we will continue to move forward. It's always seems to be one step forward, two steps back. But eventually we get there.
I agree with Susan. I think that that there does seem to be more of a pressure to include that kind of vocabulary in the way people approach media these days. But on the other hand, it does seem like you're right. It just seems like we have a long way to go.
Well, think about the concept of white privilege. If you're a white male and you get up out of the bed each morning and you're not doing anything overt to be privileged, but you are, what is it that's going to make you more aware of your privilege, or what is it that's going to make you give it up for something else? You know, if I'm a white male, why would I do something to go out of my way to give up an advantage that I have?
Well, I could think of a couple reasons, but you know, just basic compassion maybe that's not fair.
The reason that I give it up is when I see a bigger advantage in having a diverse group and being inclusive.
Right.
And I just gave you an example of how this can be very advantageous.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, all those white male leaders in the organization jumped on board very quickly because they saw that this was much better than the way they had traditionally done business. And it benefited everyone. And that's why I think it's still critically important to come up with specific examples for specific organizations. But that requires a different mindset than the traditional diversity practitioner. And I'm trying to help them become more comfortable being uncomfortable.
Sure.
And to think more like strategists and not just tacticians.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. So when are you writing your book? And
Well, I've already written one book.
Yes.
I'm actually working on a second edition. I've written a book called Thriving in a Disruptive World, Six Critical Concepts for Navigating the 21st Century. And I'm actually finalizing the second edition of that book. I wrote that about 5 years ago now. I needed to do some updates to it based on some of the things that have happened in the last few years. So I'm hoping to have that finished within the next, by the end of this year. I hope to have it out early next year. But, the original is still relevant. Mm-hmm. It still makes sense. And there's some good stories in it.
Absolutely. I can't wait to read the updates. If it's appropriate, how would a listener get in contact with you?
I'm on LinkedIn. I have a Twitter feed. And the book is available on Amazon.com and the other usual websites. You can also pick up the book through my publisher, BookLogix.com, BookLogix, BookLogix.
Right. And one more time, the title?
Thriving in a Disruptive World.
Got it.
Six Critical Concepts for Navigating the 21st Century. But if you just Google Thriving in a Disruptive World, it'll come up.
It'll come up. Yep.
Yeah. And anybody can connect to me on LinkedIn.
Fantastic.
Julius Pryor III. There is a Julius Pryor IV, so be sure you get the right one. Sometimes I get his emails, and sometimes he gets mine.
Susan, do you have anything else?
No, I think I'm all set.
Great. Mr. Pryor, thank you for taking the time to join us today. I think this has been a really good conversation.
Oh, Mickey and Susan, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for allowing me to talk to you.
You're very welcome.
And to our listeners, thanks for joining us. We'll see you in a couple weeks with another episode of the Inclusion Catalyst. Thanks very much.
And that's it for this episode of Inclusion Catalyst. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe and share with your friends and colleagues.